Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up. It is Monday, April 28th, 2025. It is, in fact, Election Day here in Canada. We'll be talking a bit about that during this show here. But we also got a lot of other good stuff for you. Election-related information. We have a report on the pros and cons of strategic voting. We also have a report on the lack of Indigenous issues as they've been somewhat lacking in this campaign, and the Indigenous community is feeling that. we have Gardening with Embark, our regular segment, and joining me in the studio here today is Stephen Fan, who's also got some arts reports.
I've actually got three little ones, but that will be later in the show, and yeah. It's going to be a pretty fact show.
Cool. And yeah, so that's our show for today. First, I'd like to talk a bit about the incidents in Vancouver this weekend on Saturday night. The tragedy at the Lapu Lapu Festival in South Vancouver, in which a vehicle right at the end of the festival, as people were packing up, but lots of people were still there, drove at high speed through the crowd, and 11 people were killed, dozens injured. According to the authorities, there's very good chance. Many people really badly injured. One witness reported people flying high up into the air as they were struck by the vehicle. 11 people have been killed. As I said, many, many more injured. There's a real fear that many more people who are currently in hospital may yet pass away, and that that number of dead could grow. Our hearts all go out to the Philippine community here in Vancouver who are most affected. The Lapu Lapu Festival was a Filipino community festival with people from around the community and vendors and performers and many, many others and families. And the whole community has been deeply, deeply affected. But the whole of Vancouver community has also been very deeply affected. This is not the kind of thing we expect to happen in Vancouver. You know, we kind of expect this kind of thing to happen in other places where world news happens, not here in Vancouver. And it's a real shock to see and to realize that this can happen here. I guess it's fortunate that, you know, authorities have ruled out the idea that it was terrorism related. The suspect was apprehended by bystanders and event security on the night of the incident. After the car finally came to a stop, he got out and attempted to run away, but was chased down and caught and held by bystanders and security until police could arrive. It appears that the incident was mental health related. The individual who's now been charged with 8 counts of murder yesterday afternoon in court was well known to police for a number of mental health incidents. And I expect a lot more information will come with that. Obviously, no matter what the reason for the tragedy, it at least, you know, it doesn't appear to be the kind of incident that might bring fear that there will be follow-ups, you know, as something that might be terrorism-related might suggest. And, of course, the incident terrorism has been ruled out as connected to this incident, which is good. So let's talk about the election, because it is election day today. And it's been a very interesting race. Stephen, when we were at New Year's time, let's just put the pin there. Yeah. It looked like the conservatives, in fact, the general consensus, and everybody believed the conservatives were set to cruise to a pretty easy victory and a big majority.
Yeah, so it's interesting because I have a political interest. I'm not really involved as much in active politics anymore, but like I keep in touch with people in politics, and you know, so like one of my friends is Brian Breguet, who is a fairly controversial BC conservative candidate from last year.
Yeah.
But like, you know, he's very personable, and so I was talking to him about this, and one thing that was always hanging over the 20-point Tory elite that was there for most of 2024 was structurally it doesn't make any sense. And what I mean by that is structurally, if you look at the trends from, let's say, the 2024 U.S. presidential election, there's been a lot of stuff happening. One of these things happening is what we call racial depolarization, which is that actually different people of different ethnicities have become voting in a more similar way to each other. So there's less difference between different ethnicities anymore. And that actually, at this stage, actually does benefit the liberals.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, and, you know, it was also based on the personal unpopularity of Justin Trudeau, and, you know, well, Justin Trudeau left.
Yeah, and the big part of, you know, the reason for the enormous, at the time, Conservative Party lead was Justin Trudeau's unpopularity and the extent to which the Conservative Party, through kind of relentless campaigning around that topic, pretty much since the beginning of Justin Trudeau's premiership, had taken what was probably, you know, a regular unpopularity of a nearly 10-year prime minister and really sort of demonized him well beyond that.
Turbocharging it.
You know, with the you know, people driving around with F. Trudeau flags and stickers on their vehicles and stuff like that. The other part of their campaign was, of course, their strong opposition to the carbon tax. And, of course, what ended up happening is Justin Trudeau quit. The Liberal Party backed away from the carbon tax, and Mark Carney showed up on the scene, and then Trump.
Yeah, so Trump is kind of the big factor here. But I remember in the fall of last year, I was speaking with the Alberta conservative staffer, and he was like, look, you know, policy-wise, Pierre Poilievre was already a man out of his time, right? He would have been perfect for the election that was 4 years ago, mm-hmm. right? In the middle of COVID, you know, people felt frustrated. And now it's just not, you have so much world sort of like geoeconomic kind of uncertainty. Nobody, like, he doesn't quite carry the image of someone you would trust to manage the economy through a crisis. I think you're right about, you know, the way this, you know, there's a question of how much intrinsic unpopularity there was for Trudeau just because he was a prime minister for 9 years. Nobody becomes more popular after becoming, you know, prime minister after 10 years. I think there's also a sense, I think actually Trudeau himself is actually much shrewder than given credit for. You know, when he left, ever since he resigned being prime minister, and he's not running for parliament again, obviously, he's kept a very low profile. Mm-hmm. He's not been in the media. He's not done any interviews. He's absolutely stayed out of any kind
of... Well, he was very prominent through the leadership campaign, because of course he was still prime minister.
Yeah.
And of course he kind of had his swan song, where instead of having to slink away, you know, disliked and you know, disrespected at the end after being forced out of office, which he was. I mean, it became apparent that he could not stay anymore. You know, he had this sort of swan song of dealing with, you know, the first stages of the Trump presidency, and you know, his handling of that was recognized as being pretty good. You know, I don't think that would have made a difference. If he'd stayed on, that would not have been enough to turn things around.
I think if he had stayed on, people would have gotten tired of it relatively quickly.
Yeah.
I don't think it would work. But I think one thing that's super interesting was when sort of Chrystia Freeland kind of did the thing end of last year, was like, you know, she dramatically resigned and, you know, challenged basically Trudeau for the leadership. I think Trudeau really had it in his mind at that point that he wanted Carney to succeed him.
Yeah.
And not necessarily just because he disliked Chrystia Freeland for what you know politicians would call backstabbing, but it's just, you know, what happens in politics. I think one thing is, I think he has come to the realization at the end of his prime ministership that a lot of the things that have gone wrong in his tenure are actually related to Freeland. And that, you know, because he was really driving the policy in the second half of his premiership. And it's, I think he has decided that it just kind of needed a different kind of prime minister. Yeah. And
although many people would argue that a lot of, you know, the policies that Freeland was pushing were, in fact, Trudeau's policies that she was, you know, obliged to follow, you know, follow her leader. And certainly the, you know, the final incident with where she, you know, resigned was that kind
I don't even remember. It was something insanely stupid.
Well, it was about those, you know, they brought in that, the GST thing and the...
Oh, it's the rebates, isn't it?
The rebates and stuff like that. That didn't land that well. You know, I think apart from Friedland's actions, you know, the fact that those things didn't land well and kind of seemed like a desperate ploy to buy voters also didn't help Trudeau's case at the time. And then they wanted her to take the, you know, take the fall for it. Anyway, you know, there were definitely, you know, there's two sides to that. But anyway,
I don't mean to blame Freeland, actually. I think what I meant to say is that my personal observation of Trudeau, like, I've been close, like, I've kind of seen them up and close. Like, I've seen his former wife. Like, I've met with Freeland before. Is I don't think Justin Trudeau is a very good judge of character. and it's... I mean that in the nicest way possible. I think if you look at the people he's grown up with, he's known for a very long time. Generally, he's worked well with them. You know, Melanie Joly, like, a lot of people don't like her, but he's worked well with her. But if you look at the people he's recruited, like, 5 years before he entered politics, like 5 years ago, there's always been a falling out. There's been a falling out with you know, Christian Freeland. There's been a falling out with, you know, let's bring play the oldies, you know, Wilson Raybould. Like, it's not to relitigate who is at fault or who is not at fault. It's just these relationships never worked out.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes I get the idea that you know, as a leader, and this is a good part, you know, he really likes working with strong characters, strong people. But also as a leader, there's a point where he just wants to get his way, and that leads to a kind of clash with some of these folks who are all, you know,
I'm not sure he is strong enough personally to handle really strong leaders effectively, mm-hmm. right? There's nothing wrong with having strong leaders in your cabinet, but you need to be able to handle them respectfully, but also firmly. JWR, like Wilson Raybould, was such a bizarre case where initially he was entirely within his legal remit, and he started messing it up, and it just kind of evolved into a highly sort of legally shady situation.
Yeah.
And it was, the whole thing was just bizarre. Like, it was, and it's very reminiscent of the way Freeland's handled. Like, you know, you can't tell your finance minister to put out a budget saying something that she disagrees with 2 days before you're going to fire her. Like, you just can't do that.
And then expect her to take the fall for any bad news that comes for it.
And it's just, I just don't think he has a good instinct for dealing with really highly professional people, that he highly accomplished professional people he's met in his political life, as opposed to, like, people he's known through his brother, he's known through his family, where he just has a much closer sense of how things are going to go.
So all that happened.
Yeah.
Trump came along.
Yeah.
Then Carney came along.
Absolutely.
So
Carney is someone I've been kind of keeping an eye on for a very long time. I actually met with Carney in January.
Yeah.
He did like a very small meet and greet. It was like 20, 30 people.
This probably would have been before he formally announced his campaign?
This is like right after he announced, like a week after he announced.
Yeah.
And for leadership of the Liberal Party. But I, you know, me and a few friends of mine have been keeping a close eye on Carney for a very long time because it's been obvious that he wants to be prime minister. He wants to be prime minister.
Yeah.
And I think, obviously, he is prime minister for the time being anyways. But, like, my impression of meeting with him is that he reminds me of a senior consultant. Like he just reminds me of like a senior like McKinsey, PwC right. kind of a consultant. Very corporate, very professional, probably very effective.
One of the terms I think could apply to him, but hasn't really been used, is sort of the idea of a technocrat, someone who has been working at high levels in government.
Yeah.
In pretty responsible positions, but not as a political figure.
Yeah.
And as governor of the Bank of Canada, and then following that, governor of the Bank of England. You know, it's a very influential position. Working at the highest level in international affairs and national affairs, but not expressly a political position. So, and then he's coming in with this experience, which of course I think has been one of the things that's been working in his favor, this sort of, you know, who's able to present himself as someone who could manage the economy effectively, et cetera, and so forth.
So I absolutely agree. I think he is, in fact, the technocrat par excellence. And if you look at the posts he's held, the governor of Bank of England, the governor of Bank of Canada, these are two of the biggest technocratic jobs you can have anywhere in the world. And so he's had them. And so I don't think that's necessarily a good thing or bad thing in terms of his political experience. It's just a thing. But he doesn't strike me as having a very natural retail politician's touch, at least kind of in my interactions mm-hmm. with him, brief interactions with him. And I think perhaps one thing that's interesting about this is that this is perhaps something that could have only taken place in a country like Canada, where we don't really like politicians to pander to our prejudices that much,
right.
Because we expect kind of a hands-off kind of administrative competence from politicians to deliver services. But it's not like, you know, we don't want, you know, like the equivalent of Trump packing football stadiums full of rallies. Like, it's just not that's yeah. interesting to us. And I think if you have it, you know, like the idea of a technocratic prime minister, typically the comparison is made with Draghi, with Mario Draghi of Italy.
In Italy, yeah.
Who was the chief of the European Central Bank before.
And became prime minister in Italy during the big economic crisis.
Yeah, but I don't think it's a perfect comparison because Draghi was never elected. Draghi was appointed in what's a European system thing, what's called a technocrat, caretaker prime minister,
yeah.
in order to get, you know, Italy over the hump. And they subsequently elected a populist named Meloni. Yeah. Actually, a really good comparison, but that's a little while ago. This guy called Manmohan Singh, I can't pronounce his name correctly, yeah. In India. And he yeah. was prime minister of India for some time in the 1990s.
Yeah.
And before that, he was actually the governor, the head of the Reserve Bank of India.
Right.
So that's actually a great comparison because he won elections, assuming if Carney wins elections.
Yeah.
I don't know about that. Singh was such a great comparison in another respect as well, is that he was also not a natural retail politician.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not like gregarious, and he's like very much a technocrat. Like, he was the head of the Central Bank of India. But India was facing some serious economic problems, very similar to the problems that Canada is having nowadays at a different level, productivity problems, basically.
Yeah.
The economy was just not being very productive. And Singh was basically brought in as kind of the technocrat in democratic guise to guide the country's economy, and India's economy has subsequently done really well. And he was successful. He was, I think, elected. I don't know if he was reelected, but he lasted quite some time.
Yeah.
And by general consensus, he's regarded as one of the most effective prime ministers of Indian recent history. And by the way, if you look at his last name, you realize how rare that is, because Singh is a Sikh last name.
Yeah.
And most prime ministers, and in fact, I think all prime ministers in India, except for him, have not been Sikh.
Yeah.
It's such a unique,
mostly from the Hindu community.
So it's a very unique yeah. situation. I think that's actually really comparable to Carney if yeah. he were to be successful.
Yeah. So then we have Polyev, mm-hmm. and he initially was pretty flat-footed, I think, in response to both to Trudeau's resignation and, you know, Trump's challenges.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't really, he, well, I think he took way too long to really respond effectively to, you know, Trump's 51st state references and the tariffs and stuff. He seemed like initially he just didn't want to, he didn't want to piss off his supporters who also support Trump. Is that what, you know, I think probably what it was. I think that really hurt him.
Yeah.
And he also tried to, when it became obvious that Carney was going to be the new leader of the party, he initially really tried to sort of employ the same sort of slander tactics, you know, and carbon tax Carney and other stuff like that, none of which really landed. And that seemed to hurt him. He's really shifted over the last 2 or 3 weeks to a bit of a different strategy, the Canada First messaging. And that seems to have worked better.
Actually, that's being retired in favor of bring it home, which is bizarre because that's a, like, I follow England football. Bring it home is like a very England football kind of thing because it's about bringing football home to England where it was invented. Association football, that's to say soccer. If you miss that context, bring it home doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
So, like, I've never understood, like, when, like, Andrew Scheer is, like, enthusiastically shouting, bring it home. And it's like, bring what home? Bring what, where? Like, it's, like, there needs to be enough context. And these are not people who, like, at least strikes me as being they follow English football that much. So I was just very confused. But on your point about Pierre Poilievre's shifts in messaging, I think the big point here to understand is that he's always been, you know, the great expression about this English politician, Boris Johnson, was that he was like the guy who wanted to have the cake and also eat it. Yeah. And I think that's the problem with Poilievre as well, is that he really desperately wants to have the cake and eat it, but he's just not very good at it. You know, it's like that. Yeah, you mentioned the way like he didn't want to split his base. You know, I think something like a quarter or like 40% of his base are like, you know, Trump, pro Trump or Trump curious. But I mean, like, we respect that. Like, it's fine. People can have their own opinions. He doesn't want to split that, causing internal party civil war. I get that part. But also at the same time, Doug Ford threaded at NATO, like literally a month ago, pretty successfully, and he was pretty full-throated in denouncing the tariffs.
I do think that's sort of one of the bits that made Poilievre look bad is that a fellow conservative like Ford stepped right in and was very bold in his messaging, and by contrast, Poilievre looked weak on that issue, right? Not just against whoever was in front of the Liberals, whether it was Trudeau at the time or later Carney, but even, you know, compared to other conservatives. And then, of course, we had Daniel Smith in Alberta saying all sorts of weird stuff that was not helpful at all.
I mean, one thing to remember is that Doug Ford has had other jobs other than politics, even if those were less than salubrious jobs. but, you know, like, I just had to fit in that dig because that was just absurd. Like, you know, Pierre Poilievre's literally never had a real job outside of politics. It's just, look, here's my take on Pierre Poilievre. Like, it's, I think, the deal is that he tries to have it too good. My most memorable realization here, the moment I realized this has nothing to do with Trump tariffs. The moment I realized this when he was talking about crime and immigration messaging. You know, like, conservative messages on crime is always tough on crime. Yeah. You know, like, but he was, on immigration was kind of like less immigration, whatever. But, like, he was trying to thread it so hard. Yeah, he was talking about how, like, temporary migrants who commit crimes in Canada will be sent back. And, like, I know that area of policy really well because, like, you know, like, it's for obscure reasons. I'm not related to it, but, like, I follow that area of policy. And suddenly it just strikes me as he's literally making a tautology because there is no such thing that would allow, like, Canadian law already does not allow temporary migrants who commit crimes to stay in Canada. It's just like, it's already established in law, like, 1,000, and there's like 1,000 different ways the law, you know, circumscribes this. And he was like, they're making like this like insane, like, he was trumping this up to be his big piece of policy in both crime and immigration, and he was stating something that was already true. It's not only already true, but it was true like 10 different ways. And it was just like he was trying to be way too sneaky about this, right? If you're going to say that we want to punish people for committing crimes, say that. If you want to say you want less immigration, say that. Stop saying this whole thing where people who are on certain kind of visas who are commit... This is like reminds me of when like Kamala Harris was originally running for president in like 2016 or whatever. Mm-hmm. And one of her policy proposals is like, oh, you know, like we do like student debt, you know, like reductions for people who start, you know, Pell Grant recipients who start a business in minority, like a minority-owned business in like disadvantaged neighborhoods for at least three, like something insane, like, you know, just insane policy contortions.
Yep.
And it was, I was just not impressed.
All right, let's talk about Jagmeet Singh then. Jagmeet Singh.
I live in his district, and he's going to lose his seat, by the way.
He's been squeezed by this whole issue. You know, we're going to talk, we have a report on strategic voting, and the idea of strategic voting, it's forefront in every Canadian campaign, but especially so this one, because there has been a lot of feeling that the people who don't want Polyev really do not want Polyev, and they're willing to change, you know, structure their voting to make sure that doesn't happen. And that seems to have entirely squeezed the NDP and Jagmeet Singh.
I will come out with a hot take against this, okay. Actually. And I know this has been the conventional wisdom, but I really don't think... Oh, let me put it this way. There's some strategic voting. Like, in a situation like this, with Trump tariffs, you know, people who don't like Polyev, who don't like Trump... are going to do some strategic voting. But I do not think strategic voting explains the majority of the NDP's vote collapse as reflected in the polls so far. And the reason I think that is that I think people fundamentally misunderstand NDP psychology.
Yeah.
I'll give you an example of how people misunderstand NDP psychology. I remember during COVID, and there was kind of the trucker convoy things.
Yeah.
I used to pop down, you know, to like the local pub. You know, it was like in the basement. It was a dive bar. And, you know, you go once in a while, you know, whatever. But the thing that's interesting about the bar was that it was all like NDP guys. It was all like NDP guys in union hats.
Yeah.
Right? And you go down during the convoy thing. It was last for 2 or 3 weeks. And you would expect these guys to be at least a little bit sympathetic. And I remember polling every single guy in the bar. The verdict was unanimous. They thought Trudeau was being too soft and he should call in the army.
Right.
So, like, I think people fundamentally misunderstand what NDPism is in a sense that they don't understand their voters. NDP has two kinds of voters. The kind of voters who are, like NDP union guys in the smaller towns and industrial places like Algoma, and also kind of urban professionals and, you know, people who are in care professions, government professions, whatever. And the thing about NDP voters shifting to Carney, I think, is that there is a long-term shift here in a sense of a lot of what's frustrating for people who voted NDP to try and pull Trudeau left during the Trudeau years was that the sense of that Trudeau was so not in control of the situation that they might as well just vote for the most left possible party to try and get the most, what they consider the most progressive outcomes. But one thing Carney has been able to do, I think in my view so far, is being able to reassure voters that he wants to deliver progressive outcomes, relatively moderately progressive outcomes, but in a way that's sustainable and competent. So it's not really clear to me that there's actually in Canada a constituency of like 20 to 30% of the population who are actually like literally on policy left of the Liberal Party. I think there are people who want progressive outcomes who are disappointed with Trudeau or who want the things to work a certain way. But are there, like, just like think about the intuitive question here. Like, are there 30% of Canadian voters who are literally left of the Liberal Party on most policy? I do not think so.
And, of course, the other part of that is the Liberal Party itself, depending on the zeitgeist, can move left or right to try and pick up those. You know, as a party of the center, they can move to the right or they can move to the left to try and...
I mean, I'm not sure if the party of the center is a party of power. But like...
I think those two things are related. And that flexibility, you know, has always worked well for them.
Yeah, I agree.
Let's take a quick look at polls because it is election day today.
Yeah.
And the way it stands now, the Liberals in national polling are at about 42, 43%. The conservatives are at 39%, which on that level is really, really